the arrival in January of Apple's new iBooks author tool for developing and publishing digital literature may signal a new phase of ebook development. That's good news for tablets and maybe not such great news for e-ink readers. At least, that's the view of PW blogger Peter Brantley. And in our weekly review of reviews, we hear about a G-rated romance for a change. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will want to talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey, Chris. Thank you.
Well, but before we get into what Peter Brantley was up to in his blog recently, what's up with Google and eBooks?
Yeah, so some interesting news this week. Our intrepid bookselling reporter Judith Rosen discovered that Google has stopped accepting applications for affiliates to its Google eBooks program. You know, that's the program that allows you to sell Google eBooks on your website. So that move was totally unannounced, but apparently it began a few weeks ago. And while that hiatus hasn't affected stores that sell Google eBooks on their websites currently, like, you know, Powell's in Portland, Oregon, one of my favorite stores, at least two booksellers in New England that we know of have been unable to submit applications. So on February 9th, someone named Getty Lee said that the Google eBooks program is not accepting new applications at this time and said new directions would be forthcoming. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, isn't Getty Lee the high-pitched lead singer of the Canadian prog metal band Rush? Well, yeah, that's what we thought too. So we contacted Google ourselves, and indeed a rep told us that, you know, the company was not prepared to talk about any new plans, which sort of suggests to us that maybe there are new plans in the works. So what is going on? Good question. You know, hopefully we can get Google to have, you know, David Lee Roth or Eric Clapton to give us more information soon. But let me say this. When it launched its cloud-based ebook vision just over 2 years ago, I was really excited for Google eBooks. But Google eBooks has pretty much been a flop. And a lot of that, I think, probably has to do with the fact that the ebook market is a hotly competitive market right now, and it's evolving very quickly, and clearly it's becoming a tablet-driven market. Now, there are rumors of a Google tablet coming soon, and maybe that will all change. But at this point, I think it's fair to question whether Google really has its heart set on getting into the ebook game. And, you know, if they're flagging a little, really, who could blame them? You know, they've litigated with publishers and authors. There's all these thorny issues popping up around ebooks. There's, you know, this hot competition with other tech companies. And face it, there are probably some other higher margin things Google engineers can focus on, like, you know, perhaps search.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. That's just what I was going to say. I mean, and now they can get back to search. And in fact, let's remember, they got into the whole book quandary because of search way back in 2004, 2005. So maybe they are kind of returning to the past there. And I think this illuminates my experience. I had Tom Turvey on a panel at Digital Book World just about a month ago, and he was, you know, short with his answers. It would be how I would put it, not in an impolite way or anything, but just he didn't have a lot to say about it, and it may well be that things were already cooking in that direction, even as Tom was sitting there with us at DBW. So great reporting there by Judith Rosen. And speaking of the developing ebook market, Monday's issue has a lot to say about that, and it's your PLA, Public Library Association, preview as well.
Yeah, that's right. So Monday's issue is our issue that will be at the Public Library Association meeting in Philadelphia. And we have 13 pages of features of great interest to libraries and publishers, of course. And my favorite piece among them is Peter Brantley, our blogger and contributing editor, who's turned in a piece on what Apple's new iBooks author tool means for the future of the book. And he makes a few great observations. And the first is that the new app raises questions about the future of EPUB 3 and open standards, because Apple, a longtime supporter of EPUB 3, a pioneer of EPUB 3, has actually forked that standard by including some proprietary extensions in the author app. But what's notable, he writes, is that Apple's forking of EPUB 3 comes via a tool for authoring, and not for reading. And that, to him, all points to this new phase of ebook development. You know, we have all these new ebook device tablets coming out, and that's clearly going to be what's going to drive innovation in ebooks. And if you have the choice of using standards or coming up with your own little thing to enhance your ebook experience for your users, you're probably going to opt to use the enhancements. So I think it points to this new era where designers are very likely going to be focusing on creating new ebook tools, some with proprietary extensions that could take advantage of all their capabilities and display really well on all these new tablet devices. So you can call that another fork in the road for ebooks. I also have an interview with legendary copyright expert Bill Patry, who is now senior copyright counsel at Google, has been for a couple of years. Bill has a new book now called How to Fix Copyright. And in the interview, you know, we had this funny moment where I brought up SOPA and PIPA and suggested that, you know, people were trying to fix copyright, that copyright reform was a hot topic. And he said, no, not really, because SOPA and PIPA are not reform efforts. They're more like updates. So I asked him, I said, Bill, does this mean, you know, copyright, do you think copyright really needs an update? And he said, no, it needs reform. Okay, reform it is. So you want to check out why Bill Patry feels copyright needs reform. That's also in Monday's issue.
So for reform, I guess he means something more than an update.
He does. In fact, he means, you know, sort of rethinking it all from the beginning. He says that, and, you know, he makes good sense, that a law that was based on the bookselling trade in London in the 1700s and 1600s isn't really fitting with the way we live our lives now.
Well, certainly looking to the future, as Bill is doing, you were doing that just recently out in Seattle.
That's right, you know, because I do believe that the children are the future. Well, at least the students are the future. So I went to Seattle recently, and I sat with Nancy Pearl in her living room, and I had a focus group with 11 very bright students in the University of Washington's Information School. That trip was prompted by some recent conversations I'd had with publishers, one of whom suggested that libraries were really not so important anymore and that librarians were, you know, mostly about shelving books in the Dewey Decimal System. Another publisher I'd spoken to recently didn't know what reader's advisory was. So I thought, you know, like, you know, wow, we're in a period now where, you know, this is important. And a lot of publishers probably don't even know what librarians are doing or what libraries really do anymore. So I wanted to introduce PW readers to some real live future librarians. So I convened this group of 11 students, and we sat around and we talked about various aspects of the library profession, what got them into it, how they view the digital world, and how they view the library in the future. Came up with some really great stuff, and that feature will be kicking off our PW PLA issue on Monday.
Well, we will look for that and look for your prognostications and also what you observed in chatting with that group. Andrew Albanese, thank you so much. And now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back as always, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
And what kind of books have you brought today?
We've got a really broad variety today in fiction. We have a book called HHHH. The third H is lowercase. I really have no idea how this is intended to be pronounced. The title is taken from the German for Himmler's brain is called Heydrich, and it's Sam Taylor's translation of the French writer Laurent Binet's novel about the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich in Prague in 1942 and the eight-hour standoff that followed it weeks later. So the novel is both a gripping account of this history and also fascinating metafiction, as it includes Binet's accounts of his own struggles with telling this very dramatic and powerful story.
Well, if we were reporting this for the Irish edition of our program, we'd call it HHH.
Indeed, but a fourth one. There are four H's.
I'm sorry, HHHH. Indeed, that would be
good. Thank you.
Okay, you've also got a book that takes us to sunnier climes, to Italy.
Yes, Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins. The title is actually taken from a description of Richard Burton at age 54. And the novel is set both in 1962 Italy, when an actress who's secretly pregnant with Richard Burton's baby is whisked away from the Cleopatra set and hidden away to avoid a media scandal. And then in present-day Los Angeles, where an elderly Italian who got to know the actress during that time comes looking for her and her child. We also review Jeffrey Archer's book Sins of the Father, which is the sequel to Only Time Will Tell, Red House by Mark Haddon, and The Lola Quartet, which is Emily St. John Mandel's confident third novel. And in fiction, we also have a Q&A with John Donatic. I mentioned this book, I think, last week. It's a debut novel called The Variations, and he discusses the challenges of writing about a priest who speaks out against the Catholic Church and eventually breaks his vows. And Donatic calls priests their own counterculture. He says they just have a fascinating world all their own.
And in Mysteries, the title takes us to Prague in 1941.
Yeah, there's a lot of history this week. Philip Kerr's Prague Fatale is his eighth novel featuring Berlin cop Bernie Günther. And in the fall of 1941, Günther travels to Prague, where he must solve a locked room murder in the country house of Reinhard Heydrich. So lots of back and forth between the various sections this week. And our reviewer says the solution to this particular mystery is worthy of Agatha Christie. We also have Libby Fisher-Hellman's A Bitter Veil. This is a standalone thriller set against the backdrop of the Iranian Revolution and the fall of the Shah, and a murder spell trouble for young Annie Schroeder and the Iranian husband she met in Chicago once they're settled in Tehran. And we have a Q&A in the mystery section as well with Jazzy McKenzie, whose novel The Fallen is her fourth, featuring South African PI Jade De Jong. And McKenzie says that relatively peaceful and crime-free St. Lucia presented a challenge as a setting for a mystery novel until she realized how vulnerable it would be to environmental sabotage. And rounding out the section, we have four reviews of mystery novels set in Canada. In the science fiction section, we have two reviews of the two volumes of a retrospective collection, stories by Carl Edward Wagner, who's one of the best horror writers of the 1970s and 80s. One of the volumes has longer stories, the other has shorter. Our reviewer says the longer stories are stronger, but all are worth reading. And Zach Parsons, who's one of the creators of the website somethingawful.com, has a new novel coming out, Liminal States. My reviewer says it is an awe-inspiring, helter-skelter journey through mind-blowing SF, Western dime novel, noir mystery, and near-future dystopian horror. And he said there's no way that a novel with so many moving parts should be able to hold together, but it really does.
No, well, you know, as always, I enjoy hearing about the various recipes for plots that all kinds of writers come up with. But this week in romance, we've got something that is kind of a look backwards. You can tell us about that and the others.
We have a great review of a book called Eden Brook, which is subtitled A Proper Romance by Julianne Donaldson. This comes out actually from an inspirational publisher, that this particular book is not intended for audiences of any particular faith, but it is a completely G-rated romance. It owes a lot to Georgette Heyer, and it's for readers who are tired of the style of romance novel that's sometimes, if you'll pardon the phrase, called porn for women. Here the romance is developed through longing glances and passionate letters, and there are no bedroom antics at all. So I sent this off to a reviewer who I know is maybe a little tired of the passionate frenzy, and that reviewer found the book incredibly captivating. And we also cover another innovative title. This is Under the Hill, Bomber's Moon by Alex Beecroft. It starts a series. And this is an inventive and powerful gay romance in England between an Indian immigrant and an older white military veteran. And they have to team up to fight off an infestation of literal fairies. Presumably the book dodges most of the obvious puns. And finally, we have a Q&A in romance with Tessa Dare, who wrote A Week to Be Wicked. And she explains that the blend of hilarious comedy and deep emotion in her own marriage led her to mix them in her books. In comics, we review Harvey Pekar's Cleveland by the late Pekar and Joseph Remnant. This is a celebration, in as much as the famously morose Pekar was capable of celebrating anything, of his hometown and the years that he spent there. It's a really, as always, you know, he really takes an unflinching look at himself as well as the world around him, and it's a must-have for any completist.
And in nonfiction, several memoirs this week take a look at some interesting lives for women.
Yeah, once again, we go back to Prague with Madeleine Albright's Prague Winter. This is an absorbing narrative of the years 1937 to 1948, and she talks about Czechoslovakia, the Holocaust, and her own childhood being raised Catholic, and then later rather famously discovering in middle life that her family was actually Jewish. And it's a moving portrait of life in the ghetto at Terezin, combined with a searching diplomatic history of Czechoslovakia's interwar democracy. We also cover Susan Sontag's As Consciousness is Harnessed to Flesh, which collects her journals and notebooks from 1964 to 1980, including aphorisms, lists, and acute observations of herself and the world around her. And we have a selection of Anne Morrow Lindbergh's letters and journals from 1947 to 1986, collected in Against Wind and Tide. Lindbergh was the wife of Charles Lindbergh. She was herself an aviator and a best-selling author, and this is a perceptive, intimate, and spirited journey of a woman as artist, wife, and mother. We have a Q&A with Rob Jovanovic, whose book Seeing the Light Inside the Velvet Underground offers an absorbing and definitive portrait of one of rock's most important bands. He said he started writing it because he was frustrated that such a book didn't already exist. And we cover Timothy Noah's The Great Divergence, which talks about growing economic inequality in America and suggests sensible, though not always politically viable, solutions. The Outsourced Self by Arlie Russell Hochschild talks about the way that many important aspects of life from birth to burial are now relegated to internet experts, quote-unquote, surrogate mothers, matchmakers, and other external figures. We have two reviews of books about the Kennedys during and after the Camelot years, six reviews of books that celebrate time, place, and nature, and we have two very interesting books of photography. I found both these reviews very compelling. We have Prom by Mary Ellen Mark. These are wonderful black and white photographic portraits of couples at high school proms around the U.S. From 2006 to 2009, and the book includes a DVD of a documentary by Mark's husband, Martin Bell, culled from interviews conducted with the subject during the photo shoots. And we also have Herb Ritt's L.A. Style by Paul Martineau, which is published to accompany a traveling exhibition that opens in Los Angeles in April. And this book draws from the archives of celebrated and influential fashion photographer Herb Ritt's, and our reviewer says it's a veritable feast for the eyes. In audiobooks, we have two P.G. Woodhouse audiobooks of note. There's Very Good Jeeves, Volume 2, read by the talented Martin Jarvis, who has portrayed legendary valet Reginald Jeeves on stage. And there's also Jeeves and Worcester, the collected radio dramas, which are six full-cast performances. They're delightful, entertaining, and hilarious. Cassandra Campbell does a smashing job narrating The Sisters by Nancy Jensen, bringing warm and rich narration to the tumultuous tale of two sisters and their abusive stepfather during the Great Depression. And back to memoir, Diane Keaton reads her own Then Again, and her personality, talent, and vulnerability shine through in her conversational narration. The reviewer says it's like you're just sitting with her and having a chat at the kitchen table.
Well, I would enjoy that, I'm sure. And in children's, we've got several books that are celebrating Poetry Month.
This is astonishing. We have an enormous 4-page spread of poetry books for kids of all ages, and I'm sure many adults will love these as well. Some of the highlights, we have Forget Me Nots, Poems to Learn by Heart, selected by Mary Ann Hoberman, who's the former U.S. Children's Poet Laureate. There's Water Sings Blue, Ocean Poems by Kate Coombs, which is full of evocative descriptions, lustily illustrated by Melo So. And Edgar Allan Poe's Pie, there's a tongue twister, this is a book of math puzzlers and classic poems by Children's Poet Laureate J. Patrick Lewis, who turns well-known poems into story problems. For example, inspired by Emily Dickinson, he writes, "My book closed twice before its close, the two opposing pages that added up to 113 were smudged around the edges." And it's delightfully illustrated by Michael Slack's bug-eyed caricatures.
Well, I love that, Rose. What a great way to engage people, and children particularly, and make them read very carefully and very closely.
So can you solve the puzzle, Chris? What are those two pages that added up to 113?
Well, you put me on the spot, didn't you? I was never very good in math. Tell us what they are.
It's 56 and 57, the two facing pages.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for that. And just don't spring math questions on me.
Okay,
anymore.
I'm sorry.
I don't mind.
I didn't mean to be cruel.
I'm a good sport, but really, frankly, I have a hard time, adding up the change to buy the newspaper in the morning. So what else have we got? We've got some children's fiction here as well.
Yeah, in children's fiction, we review The Obsidian Blade by Pete Houtman. This is the thrilling first volume of a young adult trilogy that uses time travel to explore concepts concepts of family, faith, and destiny. And The List by Siobhan Vivian is set in a high school where every year someone mysteriously puts up a list of girls named the prettiest and the ugliest in each grade. And the girls don't always react the way readers might expect.
And there's also talk of two interesting debuts.
Yeah, in our online annex, we have Michelle Stone's debut, The Iguana Tree. This is a tale of the hopes and travails of a Mexican couple attempting to emigrate to America. And well-written, expertly paced, and timely, says our reviewer. And also nonfiction author Meredith Moran's debut novel, A Theory of Small Earthquakes, addresses motherhood, gay rights, feminism, and family in the story of Allison Rose, her lover Zoe, and her beau Mark in the wake of the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. And finally, our pick of the week is Sniper by Nikolai Lilin, translated from Italian by Jamie Richards, and it's a grim, powerful novel about the savagery of the conflict between Russia and Chechnya in the 1990s.
Well, that does sound like pretty gripping stuff. I've seen some photographic essays about that conflict, and indeed a very tough place to be. Rose Fox, PW Reviews Editor, who blogs at Genreville, thank you very much for that review of our reviews.
You're very welcome.
And Andrew Albanese, as always, enjoyed having you on the program, too. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor.
Thanks, Chris. Enjoyed it myself.
We should tell everybody, finally, that Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.